This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. We know a lot about the courage and determination of soldiers during World War II, but for every military man in battle, there were men and women struggling to care for the injured. In 1943, 26 medics and nurses and their flight crew crash-landed in Nazi-occupied Albania. Months later, they were rescued, and that's all most of us knew until now. The story was classified to protect those who helped them, but writer Kate Lineberry is telling the full story now for the first time. Her new book, The Secret Rescue, chronicles how the group survived hunger, potential death, and a more than 600-mile march to the ocean before finally escaping. Kate Lineberry's written for The New York Times, National Geographic, and a former web editor for The Smithsonian. She is in town at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh tonight. She's going to be at McIntyre's Books in Farrington Village on Saturday, but here with us on The State of Things Now. Kate, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us more about this crash landing. Who was on that flight? Where were they headed? And what happened?
Sure. There were 13 nurses on board that flight, along with 13 medics and a flight crew of four. And the flight crew had never flown together before. The nurses and medics were part of an air evacuation program, which was transporting wounded and sick men from different parts of Italy throughout the Mediterranean. That morning, they were traveling from their headquarters in Catania, Sicily, to Bari, Italy, which is to the north, and got caught in a violent storm and pushed off course.
So they're off course now, and they're looking for a place to land. They realize it's going to have to be an emergency landing, and they don't really know where they are. It turns out they're in the skies over Albania. And so how do they determine? Did they find an airfield? Where do they land?
The first time they spot an airfield where they're going to land, it actually turned out to be, and you have to remember, they're thinking still that they're on the western coast of Italy. So they start to land on a field where they see a lot of abandoned German planes, which was common at the time. When they start to land, that is when the planes come to life. They realize this is an occupied field, and people start shooting at them. So they have to go up into the air, and they immediately find themselves in the path of two German fighter planes. So after dodging those, they eventually find a sliver of land in the middle of rugged mountains where they're able to crash land.
And just to locate this for you, for those who may not know where Albania is, they share the Adriatic Ocean. The Adriatic Ocean is between Italy and Albania. So there you go, and it's easy to be blown off course. You find yourself in the rugged mountains of Albania, crash landed, and everyone survived.
It was pretty incredible that they did. The crew chief was in the back of the plane, and he was the only one who was unbuckled. So he was severely injured in the crash landing. But it was pretty phenomenal that it wasn't more serious injuries.
So now here they are, 30 people all told, in the mountains of they don't know where yet, although they know they're in hostile territory. One of their number is critically injured. What do they do next?
They start looking at the surrounding area, but it's only a few minutes before this rugged group of men armed come out from the woods. And that's when, luckily, one of them spoke English. He had learned English at an Albanian Red Cross school. And he's able to talk to them, and they figure out they are in Albania and that the Germans are only about 4 hours away. So these men, who are part of a resistance group, actually offer to escort them to a place where they can get some food and shelter.
Well, and the critically wounded crew member, how do they get him out?
They actually have to take apart the seats in the plane and use it as a stretcher. It was mostly his knee was very damaged. The nurses were worried that he had internal injuries, but that seemed to pass over the next few days, their concerns.
This story had gone largely untold until now. How did you find out about this story?
I was doing some research on another World War II story when I came across a historic newspaper article about it and just found it fascinating, particularly with the women involved. You hear a lot of stories about downed airmen finding their way back, but to have such a large group, number one, and then number two, to have 13 women as part of it, very much intrigued me. So I started doing research and then ultimately decided I could tell this story in book format when I learned that one of the survivors was still alive and willing to work with me.
And that's Harold Hayes.
Correct.
Tell us more about him and what happened when you contacted him and said you're interested in hearing his story.
He's currently 91. When I started working with him, he was 89, and he lives in Oregon and has an incredible memory. He actually wrote his own memoir in 1990. So that was helpful in keeping all the details straight for him. But he was not sure that there would be an audience for this story, which I found incredible. And I assured him there would be. But we worked closely together. He's at 91. He's on email. He, you know, I went and stayed with them for a few weeks to interview him thoroughly on it. And he was really excited to have the story told for the first time in full.
What happens? You've got these, as you say, these guys come out of the woods. They're armed. Now, clearly, they're not wearing Nazi uniforms. So I don't know. Did that come as a relief to this party or not? They're armed and they certainly don't speak English right off the bat, right?
They were definitely worried, particularly when they told them, the partisans told them that they had considered shooting down their plane until they saw a white star on the plane. And because the partisans were in line with communism, they wore red stars on their hats. They thought that was a good sign, so they decided not to shoot it down. But they were wearing homemade uniforms, had daggers and other weapons. And the Americans really didn't have any other choice but to trust them. So they were still pretty shaken by the crash landing, but I think they were relieved to find someone who spoke English and to think that they, you know, would find help if they went with these people.
And they did. So tell us about that when they get out of the woods and they find the first village that they travel to.
They stay in the first village just for a couple nights as the local commander tries to get word from other partisans what he should do with these Americans. And they're told to take them to Berat, which is a larger town of about 10,000. So they do make it there. And they're there for a few days before there is a German attack on the town. And that's when the group, they wake up, they're all staying in different homes, and they wake up to this attack and are scattered. And three of the nurses actually are separated from the rest of the group from that point on. So it was a matter of fleeing for their lives at that point.
Did they have any contact with American officials at this point early on in this ordeal?
They didn't. And that was one of their biggest concerns, was that no one knew where they were. No one would be looking in Albania for them. So it actually took them 3 weeks before they were able to locate British officers secretly working in the country. And from there, those British officers were able to let the American military know that the Americans were in their hands.
All right. So now at this point, we're 3 weeks on. The group has been scattered. But at least they know. Did they all know that the three nurses who had become separated, were they aware of the fact that the Americans had been contacted?
They were not. And actually, their rescue was a lot longer. They were actually in the country for several more months. But they were hidden in a home for much of that time period. But the other group, the larger group, once they finally are reconnected, they realize there are three of them. The nurses are missing, and they don't know if they're alive or dead.
Are they escorted this whole time by partisans?
They are. They are until they meet up with the British, and then the partisans continue to help at that point. But the British are in charge at that point.
What about the local folks? This is dangerous territory now. You're in occupied Germany. There are partisans. And I suppose we should point out at this point that we hear about resistance movements in France and Albania. And these are not united fronts. These are people who in peacetime are at each other's throats. And so knowing who's your friend and who isn't, even among partisans, can be pretty difficult for the local population, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, the Americans soon realize that they're in the middle of a civil war going on between two of the resistance groups. But the local people who were not involved in either resistance groups are one of the true heroes of the story. They, you know, hid them in their homes and gave them food when they had barely anything to share. And if they had been caught by the Germans, they certainly would have been killed.
So talk about that and the relationship between these folks, and I guess we'll stick with the main body now and their relationship with local villagers who took them in and risked their lives, really, to protect them.
Well, they had to keep moving this whole time because if they were in one village for more than a day or two, it would deplete their entire supply of food. So they had to keep moving, and luckily they had the partisans to talk to the local village councils before they got there, make sure it was okay. There were a few occasions where they were turned away when the villagers were just too scared to house them, but for the most part, they always found people who were willing to help. And how much food an individual got depended on which house they were assigned to. There were about three assigned to each home.
Were they treated generally treated well?
They were. And in fact, when I went to Albania this past spring, I actually delivered a letter of thanks from Harold Hayes to the Albanian people because he was so grateful to all that they did for them. He does not think they would have survived. This was in wintertime as well. So the brutal winter, no food, they know that they wouldn't have survived without the help of the Albanian people.
And this is the mountainous region of Albania. And Albania, I will tell you, having traveled there, is a wildlife refuge for human compassion, as far as I'm concerned. It is a real, I've never met more compassionate, hospitable people. And the mountains in particular, the code of hospitality there is strong, and I would guess in the 1940s even stronger than it might be today.
I agree with you completely. It was something that they call Besa, and it's a tradition of hospitality that they have. And they actually, a lot of Jews during World War II actually fled to Albania and were hidden there.
And the partisans, too, remember, they're fighting two wars, essentially. They've got a civil war going on. They're fighting the Nazis. This is a dangerous time. And here are these foreigners whose bad luck got them there. You could very easily just drop them off and say, folks, I got a war to fight. Sorry to hear about your plane crash. They stayed with them this whole time and were their escorts and guides through the mountains.
They did. And there was some question at times the Americans became distrustful of them because they were trying to get toward the coast in western Albania, and they felt like they were moving toward the east. So there was definitely some distrust in the group. But overall, they found them places to shelter and eat, and they were very grateful for that.
Now, tell us about these three nurses who got separated. They have quite a story themselves.
They do. Well, Lloyd Smith was an OSS officer, and OSS is the Office of Strategic Services. It's the precursor to today's CIA. He was sent in to help get the Americans out, and he was sent in again to get the three other nurses out. Actually, this time he was being helped by the rivals of the partisans, which is kind of an interesting twist to the story. But they're able to get the nurses to the coast and also have a sea evacuation for those three women.
This is part of that code. This is part of that crazy code of hospitality that says, whatever our differences, these people need help. We're going to deliver the help. Even if you had committed a crime, if you've come to my house, I have to feed you, take care of you, and then give you a 3-day head start before I kill you for killing my brother. I mean, that's the
correct.
Code. That is the code, right? So this is part of this incredible story. And that at one point, these three women, there was a Nazi patrol that came into the village, and this was a pretty scary time for the villagers and certainly for them. Tell us that story.
It was the day after the Germans had occupied the town. The two Germans came to the house where the women were staying, and they never knew why the Germans did not turn them in. They saw them. They were hiding in the basement. They easily could have turned them in at that moment. I was able to find a little boy who was living in the house at the time. He was 7. He's now, of course, retired. And he explained to me why the Germans actually helped the women. His uncle was making wine and selling it and had a relationship with a lot of the local Germans in the area. So he was able to convince them to turn an eye to the nurses being in the basement.
The secret of Santa Vittoria. What an amazing... And there were a lot of strange things along the... How long were they in Albania before they were rescued?
The larger group was there for several months, 2 months, over 2 months, and the three nurses were there for about 4 months.
A lot of strange experiences, including a group of medics accused of stealing a sacred rock. Tell us that story.
That's correct. They were in a very small village, and what the partisans were asking of them, they didn't quite understand why, but they went along with it. And they met an imam, a Muslim priest, who explained to them that he had been to Mecca and that he deserved their respect. What the purpose of that meeting was, they weren't sure, but they left the village soon after that. And about 4 hours later, some Albanian villagers came running behind them and explained. The Americans could tell something was very much wrong, even though it was in Albanian, because of their tone. It turns out someone had stolen a sacred rock from that imam's chambers, and they wanted it back. After a few awkward moments of silence, one of the medics actually coughed up the rock and the stone and was immediately cursed by the Albanian. And actually, a few weeks later, he does become one of the most ill in the group.
Yeah. Did Harold tell you about that? I mean, did they ever sort of unpack that story? Why would you take something from these people who have been so good to us?
You know, I think that the medic, you know, a lot of these guys were very, very young. They were in a new place. You know, you know, why he did it, I don't know. It's lost to time, but I don't think he understood the gravity of what he was doing.
So tell us about the rescue then. It took British and American intelligence to combine to help get these folks out, right?
Correct. After, you know, the group, the largest group, walked more than 600 miles total before they were taken to the sea for a sea evacuation. There was an attempted air evacuation. It did not go well. They were not able to get out that way. But ultimately, they were able to get out by boat. And it was after a grueling days of walking without any sleep. And they did it because they would do anything. They were given the choice by OSS officer Lloyd Smith to wait a day or two to rest and kind of recuperate. And they all said, no, we have to go.
And there was in fact, an aborted attempt to rescue them because the town had suddenly become occupied by Germans. Tell us that story.
At one point, before the Americans meet up with the OSS officer and they're being escorted by the British, they learn that they have to start backtracking. And it was just too much for the group. They were tired. They were ill. They had lice and dysentery. And it had been, you know, weeks and weeks of this kind of treatment. And they decided that they'd had enough. They had seen an airfield that could be used for an evacuation. So while the British officer is away on a reconnaissance mission, the pilot is able to get his wireless operator to send a message on his behalf asking for an air evacuation. This was against the British officer's wishes. But that does put something in motion. And a few days later, there is an attempted air evacuation. And it's a gigantic effort on the American military's part. They send in several 21 P-38s as well as a Wellington bomber and two C-47s to get them out. But because the Germans had moved into the town above the airfield, it didn't happen.
There's this awful moment when the signal to that it was safe to land would have been a giant X using parachute material on this makeshift landing strip, and they can't do it. And they hear the planes and they see the planes and they realize we can't bring them in.
Yes, in fact, when some of the Americans were debriefed when they got back, they talked about how at one moment it was the darkest part of their journey, you know, having to sit there and watch these planes come in, and they're so close to getting out. On the other hand, several of them were overwhelmed by the effort being made, not only by the Americans, but also the British. That bomber, the Wellington bomber, was sent by the British. So there was a massive attempt to try to get them out. And that really, I think, gave them the morale boost that they needed to keep going.
And they did get out. But because it was with the help of British and American security and intelligence, the story's been under wraps until now, right?
Correct. During the war, they didn't want to jeopardize any future downed airmen from not being able to get the help that they wanted if they were in Albania. After the war, the group was concerned about Enver Hoxha, who became the dictator of Albania, retaliating against them for helping the Americans. So the American group continued after the war to keep this a secret.
It's finally out now. You've told the story. The lone survivor is Harold Hayes, who you've spoken with. What does he think of this now that it's in print and bound and out in the world?
He's really excited about it. He's been a great sport. We had the launch of the book with him, and we spoke at his retirement community, and he's being treated a little bit like a celebrity. But he's just thrilled to have the story out, and I think he always says the medics and the nurses were not heroes. They did what anyone would have done in the situation. But, you know, it took a lot of courage to keep going when it really looked like there was no chance of ever getting out. So he is a hero to me. And of course, the Albanian people are heroes, and the British and American clandestine organizations were also heroes in the story.
Your interview with Harold Hayes is online right now. We can at the National Geographic website?
Yes, nationalgeographic.com. An interview I did with him last week is up.
And what about the injured crew member? Was he getting professional help along the way, and how did he fare afterward?
He always had a limp afterward, but he was able to make it for the rest of the time. He was on a mule most of the time if he wasn't being carried by stretcher.
Kate, an amazing story. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Kate Lineberry has written for the New York Times, National Geographic, former web editor for Smithsonian. Her new book is called The Secret Rescue, An Untold Story of American Nurses and Medics Behind Nazi Lines. She'll be at Quail Ridge Books and Music in Raleigh tonight, 7:30, then McIntyre's Books in Farrington Village, Saturday at 11. For more information, go to our website, wunc.org. Next up, one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People of 2013 here at Durham, at Duke, and we will talk with her in a moment. Stay tuned.